Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. China loves its children. So many families have only one. And China loves harmony. It's the government's top theme. But in China lately, there has been a mini epidemic of men, mostly men, grabbing a knife or a meat cleaver and attacking school children. Madmen, probably, and yet people can't help but wonder if everyday life in the new China is just a little too hard, too unfair, too repressed. Even the government admits there may be a bigger problem. Here's state-run CCTV on the killings.
The Chinese government has vowed to severely punish attackers that target school children. Officials also said the government would look into root causes of social conflicts.
This hour, On Point, a country's school killings and what they may say about life behind the proud face of the new China. You can join the conversation. What do you make of these bloody attacks on school children? Do you know the new China? Do you think these attacks tell a bigger story? What is it? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Beijing is Edward Wong. He covers China for the New York Times. Ed Wong, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I should say right off the top here that we're not here today to throw stones. Lord knows we have enough problems and all kinds of violence in our own country. But we're here to try and understand. Give us the latest, Ed. What's the count on the number of these attacks and the death and wounded number at this point?
Well, right now there's been a series of, generally people say there's been a series of five attacks. All of these have taken place at schools where the main victims have been children. And so far 17 people have been killed, and there have been dozens who are injured. The vast majority of the people who've been killed and injured are school children.
Now, it seems to be leaking out potentially if it's related in other directions. We saw somebody with a meat cleaver in the South just in the last couple of days chasing girls through a market, not just in schools, but give us a sense of some of those school attacks, one or two of them, Ed, and what went on?
Well, the one you just mentioned, for example, that was the deadliest one. And in that case, a man who was living in the village, I mean, the setting is a very small village, and the school is a private kindergarten. In the village, only around 20 students in total attended the school. And the landlord of the school, the man who's renting the building out to the school manager, came into the school one day, had an argument with the manager, who was a woman who had been teaching at the school for quite a while. And then he took out came back with a meat cleaver, hacked her to death, hacked the student next to her to death, and then went on to injure and kill many other students. He also killed the school manager's 80-year-old mother. So that's an example of, that's the deadliest and most probably most gruesome of the attacks. In the one that took place before that, a man barged into another school and attacked several children and then doused himself with gasoline, grabbed two of the children and tried to set himself on fire. He did set himself on fire, but the children were rescued, and they were the two that he held did not die. And no one was killed in that attack, but there were many people who were injured.
And take us back to the first attack that sort of appears to have kicked off this string of attacks back in March 23rd.
That took place at a school, and there were school children who were right outside the school, and they were attacked by a man with a knife. It was a stabbing incident, and in that incident, he killed a total of eight people. There have only been two incidents where there were fatalities, and that was one of them. The other one was the earlier one I mentioned, which is the last incident that took place just last week, as you know.
But you're talking about many wounded as well. These are kind of wild, flailing attacks, sometimes quite deadly. But very bloody. We've seen the reports of just how widespread the worry is at this point. Guards posted and so on. If you'll stand by for just a second, Ed, here's a woman, Sabrina, in Beijing, the capital of China, talking to the BBC about how worried she is in the capital city about sending her child to school.
If it happened in the school, I really have no idea. I think I need to choose a good school and a safe school. That's the only thing I can do. The people around me, they talk about this a lot, yeah. A lot of moms, they're worried about it happen again.
And it's not just Chinese mothers worried about this. The concern has gone right up to the very top of the hierarchy in hierarchical China. Here's a television interview last Thursday with Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao voicing his concern about the killings.
The Chinese government takes this matter seriously. I feel deep sorrow for the children who were hurt or died because of this series of incidents. Apart from toughening up safety measures, we also need to pay attention to the underlying causes. We are making serious efforts in tackling social tensions, settling disputes, and improving local government's ability to smooth things out.
Ed Wong is with us from Beijing, the New York Times correspondent there. Ed, how is the government responding to the killings, the attacks?
They've been encouraging security forces to appear at the schools. They've been beefing up security at schools. They've had emergency conference calls with police chiefs around the country, and there have been some training sessions for private security guards and police officers on how to deal with people who barge into schools, armed assailants. They're also trying to be very careful about what kind of news of these attacks gets out. They've been a lot of news organizations have not reported fully or given full follow details in follow-up stories on these attacks. There's been a ban or orders not to report in detail on the killers or their motivations or on the victims. The officials say that's because they want to prevent other copycat attacks from taking place. But at the same time, there's also China often censors stories that show deep social disturbances. And this is definitely a case where there is questions are being raised about the social fabric of China, and I think the government is anxious or nervous about that.
No country would like to see this going on, and no government, but you've written that the Chinese government is particularly sensitive about this. Why?
It's sensitive because it has long been on propaganda drive to try and portray China as a harmonious society. It tries to portray that to the Chinese citizens because it prizes social stability. It also is sensitive to any incidents that might call into question the legitimacy of the party. And I think that when Chinese citizens see an inability by the government to protect children, then that is a particular weak point for the government. There have been several incidents in the last few years where children have become victims. There was a famous long series of tainted milk cases where children are falling ill from tainted baby formula and tainted milk, and then there were many children killed in schools that were poorly constructed in a 2008 earthquake here. And so I think that, and those raised lots of questions about the government and the way it handles these and the way how much oversight it gave to things that could potentially harm children in the society here. And I think that this case, the series of attacks, raises the same kinds of questions.
Ed, what portion of Chinese families now only have one child? We know they long had, perhaps still have, the one-child policy to control the population. Is that still in effect? And what portion of Chinese families are single-child families?
Oh, of the Chinese families that do have children, the overwhelming majority of them have just one child. The policy applies to almost every part of China. There are some exceptions like the ethnic minority areas where people are generally allowed to have two, three, maybe four children without penalties. But in general, Chinese families are penalized heavily if they have more than one child.
So this is a terrible tragedy for any Chinese family that it hits, for any family anywhere. But if there's only one child, that's it. And we'll look at this in more depth, but what's the range of causes people are contemplating, considering in China?
Well, The police did have been investigating this, obviously, and the reports that we've seen in the official news media citing police officials show that in at least three of the five cases, the assailants had histories of mental illness or showed clear signs of having mental illness even before they carried out the attack. So I think one of the things that we see as a common thread through the majority of these cases is mental illness. And the other thing is the other hypothesis that's being put out there is that perhaps these men were trying to make a statement to society. They were trying to cry out to society to lash out at society. And this killing children in large numbers in China seems to be a very, very easy way of getting people's attention. I think it would get people's attention anywhere, but in China, like this particular type of attack really rivets the attention of people everywhere in the country, and there's theories as to why these men feel the need to do that, but people think that it's sort of a attack on society in general.
Ed Wong, Beijing correspondent for the New York Times. Ed, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the attacks on school children in China, asking what's going on behind the public face of China on the rise. No country would be happy with this. Many countries over time have had all kinds of problems, even counterparts of this. But in China, the whole country is riveted at this point to the extent they know about it. Lots of censorship around this. After the most recent killing of seven children in the rural village of Linchang last Wednesday, it's in Shaanxi province, a local resident spoke out in disbelief here to the BBC.
He was very good to his mother. He was not an impolite person. When this happened yesterday, we could not believe it.
Joining us right now from New York is Wobin Yang. He teaches sociology at Barnard College and the Weatherhead East Asian Institute, both at Columbia University. He's author of several books, most recently The Power of the Internet in China, Citizen Activism Online. Wobin Yang, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Shanghai in China is David Westendorf. He's the founder of Urban China Partners, an urban governance and management consulting firm based in Shanghai, long-term resident there, a former research fellow at the UN Research Institute for Social Development in Geneva. David Westendorf, thank you very much for being here.
Glad to be here, Tom.
David, first to you. You're in China. You're there in Shanghai. What are you seeing and hearing? Does everybody know about this? Are people all talking about it? Is it so censored that Chinese themselves don't know the scope of the attacks?
I think Shanghai people are probably among the best informed in China. So I think everybody knows about it, despite the fact that there is the Shanghai Expo going on. I think in some respects these stories may have attracted even a bit more attention than what's happening at the Expo. I think people in Shanghai are definitely aware, but I think they're also thinking it can't happen here in Shanghai.
And, of course, we hope it doesn't. We hope it doesn't happen anywhere else. But to have more attention on this in some dimensions than the huge Shanghai Expo is kind of incredible in itself. Wobin Yang, you're a sociologist. You know China well. You follow it closely. What are your thoughts as you see these news reports come in about what may be going on here?
Well, I think it's certainly a horrific incident and extremely baffling to many people, you know, families and parents, as well as scholars. And scholars have been trying very hard to come up with ways of understanding these events. I think it's difficult at this point to come up with, you know, good explanations. A lot of the facts we are not terribly clear yet. Five cases, five murderers. There are some patterns there, but then it's hard to go from there to try to derive broader patterns. But as Ed Wang earlier on mentioned, the number of explanations out there, hypotheses, I think I would only consider this mm-hmm. as hypotheses, mm-hmm. that there are certainly possibilities of mental illnesses. There is the possibility of a series of copycat crimes happening close, together. So these are more or less ways of trying to understand individual motivations, and I think it's terribly difficult to understand individual explanations. On the other hand, there are efforts to try to link these to, even if isolated incidents, to broader patterns of social change and social conflicts. And as you mentioned early on, even China's premier, Wen Jiabao, has spoken publicly about the need to really try to understand the broader social issues that these, I think, may be revealing. So in view of these, a number of explanations, what I think is important at this point for families and scholars alike is to try to use this occasion to look deep inside into Chinese society, an occasion for soul-searching, to think about what's happening. So I think these are a number of these things, and I see that even though these are isolated incidents, we also know quite well that in recent years there's been growing number of protests, all kinds of protest activities on various kinds of issues, suicide attempts and so on. They're very different acts, of course, but we need to explore whether or not there are some underlying common factors.
David Westendorf, The New York Times asked a number of scholars about this, and they had all kinds of answers. Zhuigang Zhou said it reflects widespread and rapidly rising social anxiety, frustration, tensions. They quote Cindy Fang talking about the gap between rich and poor in China and the big stigma about mental illness. Guobin Yang himself is quoted there. He said to the Times, these attacks are only the most explosive and brutal symptoms of an increasingly sullen and contentious society. Do you see those things, David?
I think that I do see those things. Not quite as overtly as the events that we are describing, but I think very jarring social changes have happened in China as the distribution of wealth has become extremely skewed. It's now its Gini coefficient is probably among the worst of any large country right now, and that's happened in a very short period of time. And so there's great wealth in many of these cities juxtaposed to people who worked hard for most of their lives and did what they were told to do and have come up pretty short in the later stages of their lives. And the changes are quite stark. So, there are some pretty serious scholars of Chinese history who have also written about suicide as resistance in Chinese society. And so I think, there is the possibility that people who perhaps are not fully healthy and are soured on what has happened to their lives may actually, be influenced by these philosophical principles that have been expressed for a long time in Chinese history. So I think it's quite a real possibility that there are these great tensions in society that may show up in other other ways and means and places in the coming years.
You know, David, you and I go way back to Hong Kong days years ago, and maybe just one thing culturally here, the fact that these are knives or machetes or meat cleavers, it can sound strange in the United States, but that is kind of, that's one of the sort of known patterns of outburst. I remember in Hong Kong years ago, every so often somebody would go nuts with a cleaver.
Yeah. Well, this weapon of choice in China actually makes sense to the extent that the government did one of the smartest things ever by outlawing handguns and pistols and other forms of high-velocity weapons that can do massive damage and do in many other societies. Here, a chopper you can buy at the grocery store or some other store, but you know, it's a lot harder to kill a lot of people with a chopper because somebody's going to intervene. But with, you know, machine guns or other kinds of tools of mass destruction in populated places, it's still there's a low death rate or murder rate in China compared to most other countries. It really is much lower than, say, the United States or many other countries in the region. So,
yeah, absolutely. We acknowledge that. And, of course, Americans know all about killings with guns and how high the death toll can be. But Guobin Yang, the death tolls here show quite a fury. I mean, we've got seven or eight at a go in some of these killings. What did you mean when you said these attacks are only the most explosive and brutal symptoms of an increasingly sullen and contentious society?
Right. I mean this in two senses. I think David just mentioned the issue of social inequality. I think on the one hand, it's a reflective of the social problems that's being accumulating in China. And we might say the fundamental issue is about the increasing gaps between the rich and the poor, and many, many people being left behind in the process of rapid economic development. But this is sort of, we also need to go from there to try to explore how this kind of new social inequality affects, let's say, family relations, community, schools, and people's willingness to help each other. I think these are some of the tensions that, because of these, the great tensions, crisis and so on. I see, we have stories about people unwilling to help strangers, and because of the possibility of all kinds of sort of unexpected, there are stories in recent years about stranger helping stranger, but then being taken to court for that kind of behavior. So, in other words, some of the tensions, these are some of the examples of the tensions. School children, really very heavy burden in study for exams and so on. No time, I think, very little time for social activities, community building activities. So this is one side of the story. It's about mainly about the social tensions, social inequality, and social troubles, community troubles. But these are also related in very important ways to some political issues, issues of the law and system of law and justice. Again, we have numerous stories where people try to seek justice, but there are no institutional channels of making work. Not very effective. People have nowhere to turn to. Local government authorities are not necessarily the best channels of seeking justice. So these are also, I think, very important. Another underlying cause, in terms of how, where people can turn to when they need help, when they need to seek justice. And so this is another part of the of the sort of some of the tensions. It's more political tensions. So together, I think we see, that's why we see suicides, increasing number of suicides, even among the middle class. We used to know, we know that suicide rates among women are the highest in the world, and that's not the typical pattern, according to our scholars who study this phenomenon. And I mentioned protest activities. We have stories about the workers in IT companies who, you know, series of suicides.
So do you see these suicides and these attacks on schools in some dimension as political protests then?
Well, yeah, you know, David just mentioned it's, you know, suicide is a way of protest often, that, you know, when people are feel completely helpless, what can they do? They commit violence against themselves as a way of protest. And, you know, this is not just a contemporary problem or a Chinese problem. Mm-hmm. It is it's common in history and in different societies.
Let me, if I may, turn to our listeners. We have a lot calling in and to join us here. Let me go first to Vera, calling from Middletown, Connecticut. Vera, you're on the air.
Hello. My name is Vera Schwartz. I teach Chinese history at Wesleyan University, and I've done some work on the history of psychology in modern China. And mm-hmm. I think part of what we're seeing today is extraordinary casualty nationwide in China for having ostracized psychology as bourgeois. During the Cultural Revolution, the few practicing psychologists were persecuted, often to death. And so I think the country was left, you know, with herbal supplements and acupuncture as a solution for far greater problems than they could handle. So the good news is that there are, in fact, some often Western-trained psychologists that are going back, especially to the countryside. An interesting organization is called World Links. Mm-hmm. That is really trying to get some acknowledgement in the countryside, what it's like to see someone that's mad, as opposed to ill in some other way or just discontent. So I think part of what we're seeing is a nationwide call to rehabilitate the dignity of psychology, not just simply as a Western babble, but as something that suits Chinese wounded souls. The other thing I think we need to acknowledge for ourselves is that China, you know, I've been going to China for 4 decades, mm-hmm. and the rate of change that my Chinese friends have experienced in their lifetime is truly beyond, I think, anything that I know as a historian, both of China and of the West. Mm-hmm. So people's ability to absorb this extraordinarily rapid, you know, physical landscape, you know, everything is being rebuilt all the time. So I think you have this cognitive disorientation that's incredibly acute in the countryside as well as in the cities.
And what about a political protest angle here as well, Vera? Do you see that or not? Do you see it primarily as simply mental health?
Well, you know, for example, the last, stabbing in Xi'an, you know, the story is that the man's land has been confiscated. He tried to work through channels to get some compensation for the money. He didn't get it. And then you have the most vulnerable, whose calls for justice have not been answered, attacking the most vulnerable. So somebody whose voice doesn't count, attacking children who are cherished but who's also totally vulnerable. So I'm not sure whether this qualifies as protest. I think there's protest in the environmental movement in China, there's protest on the intellectual scene like Charter 8. But I'm not sure I would see the stabbings as protest. It is a sense of unbearableness and that my voice doesn't matter, which is both individual and collective, which is not the same as protest. It is this deafening silence at the official level about local grievances. And that's, I think, as somebody else said, it's an old Chinese problem. Emperors are always disconnected from the situation at the local level.
And maybe a bigger problem than ever when change is as rapid as it has been. Vera, thank you for calling. The Telegraph in the UK writing recently, no country has ever, they wrote, gone through such a dramatic transformation, both socially and economically. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the attacks on school children in China and what's going on behind the public face of China on the rise. We've been joined from Shanghai by David Westendorf, founder of Urban China Partners, an urban governance and management consulting firm in Shanghai, and from New York by Guobin Yang. He teaches sociology at Barnard College at Columbia University, author of The Power of the Internet in China and Re-envisioning the Chinese Revolution. We had a caller on mental health issues in China, and here's some tape from Dr. Xin Yu, director of the Institute of Mental Health in Beijing, talking with the BBC about how difficult it is to access mental health assistance today in China.
The problem is we do not have enough mental health professionals who offer the proper psychiatric services that people really need. I think because in the past, people think that psychiatric hospitals is a place where people only lock patients up. So the medical professionals are not regarded as part of the medical profession. It's not an attractive profession for both doctors and nurses.
There's the word on mental health professionals, the sympathetic side. Here's the tough side from Wu Heping, spokesman for China's Ministry of Public Security, speaking over the weekend to China's state-run CCTV.
I think this kind of crime should be condemned by the whole society and deserves the outrage of all Chinese people. The public security bureaus and judicial authorities will severely punish this kind of crime according to the law.
Let's go to our listeners. Thierry is calling from Montreal in Canada. Thierry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great show as always. I grew up in Hong Kong from 58 to 69, and like as you mentioned earlier on, we always had that kind of individual who was somewhat deranged and went on a killing spree with a cleaver or a knife. Mm-hmm. So that's an old story. I think in China, though, there's probably more frustration dealing with the bureaucracy. And so not only do you have deranged individuals, but you also have the frustrated ones. What's surprising is that they don't take it out on officials, the ones who are, you know, arbitrarily confiscating their homes and demolishing them. You'd expect them to take it out on them. Instead, I guess turning to children is also a political statement because children are so precious and valued in China because you can only have one child officially. And so I guess you can do the most damage and draw the most attention to your cause by taking it out on them. And it's obviously very unfortunate.
Yes.
There's also a third group, and that's the copycat phenomenon. You know, we see it in North America as well. You get a movie where some kid lies on the road and lets trucks pass over, and then other kids copy. So, you know, that's an old weakness of human beings, I guess.
Terry, it sounds like you know of what you speak. David Westendorf, let me take that to you. Ed Wong with the New York Times wrote, Thierry says, you know, they can't take things out on officials if they have frustrations. But Ed Wong wrote that causing problems for the powerful is believed to be one possible motive here. What about this as a way of causing problems for officialdom that's not responsive, David?
Well, in fact, this is very much a problem for local officials because when an incident like this occurs, a black mark goes right into the book of that official who is responsible for that neighborhood or for the public security in a certain area. So, yes, indeed, those black marks do influence the prospects for promotion for local authorities. So, yes, that could very well be it. I wonder if you might let me say a few things about maybe some structural reasons behind this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, since the late 80s and right through the 90s, still most employees in cities were gathered under what was called the Danwei. It's an overarching structure that provides employment, housing, health care, education for the children, and a network of relationships that's very close because people stay together or did stay together in those relationships almost for their entire working life and even beyond,
mm-hmm.
because they would even bury you when it came time for that. Now, one of the things that tight community did was keep an eye on everybody within the community. And when people were noticed for being difficult or having problems, there were grannies or uncles or other people in this Danwei who were given the responsibility to kind of tail the person, talk to them, try to, you know, find out what's really eating them and so on. So with the dissolution of these institutions, particularly rapidly in the late 80s and through the 90s, people got lost. And they didn't have these kind of family-like mechanisms mm-hmm. where you could talk things out with people. And as they say, you know, to adjust, to help, and so on. And so a lot of people now live in gated communities, or they lost their housing that they had with the Dunway, and so now they live in a little room in the back of a restaurant or something, and they've lost their social fabric that kind of helped them stay together.
Yeah.
So this is I think there's a lot of this in the problem, or the problems that are emerging with the very glitzy new China.
Guobin Yang, Ed Wong wrote about that kind of problem as well, and the big dynamics flowing around people. He said these attacks have fueled a growing sense that China is being wrenched apart by powerful forces, including massive internal migration for employment, as David talks about, a widening income gap between rich and poor, and widespread corruption. What about the structural issues here?
Well, I think these really are the processes of rapid, extraordinarily rapid economic transformation. And you know, the migration patterns is also another, you know, part of the structural change of population
from huge country to industrial zones.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, countryside being developed into factories, and a lot of especially the young population leaving their hometowns to find work in the cities, and for many of them, it's an experience of uprootedness, and then they have to find their new communities. But I think the structural problems are not just economic structural problem or demographic change. It also has a lot to do with the kind of bureaucratic structures, political institutions, that the old institutions, the old bureaucratic structures, old ways of governance do not seem to be very adequate in dealing with these kind of rapid changes. And take the example of these, security guards on campuses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not a common phenomena in Chinese schools. You know, in old days, mm-hmm. School campuses are safe places, safe havens almost. You don't have security guards guarding the, you do have entrance guards, but you don't have police.
Mm-hmm.
But now in recent years, there have developed these kind of security guards, but they are for gated communities, for schools that are relatively doing well,
mm-hmm.
but not for those kids in the rural areas, as in the most recent case in Shaanxi, the little mm-hmm. village kindergarten.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think these are also some of the issues there.
Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and Seth. Seth, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, do you think I can say something you probably don't want to hear?
We're happy to hear whatever you have to say, Seth.
Yeah, my point, I'm disappointed because this, the point, the talk is making me uncomfortable because you try to bring all those social issues, China uprising or migrant or that way. But if you look at each case bears nothing what we just try to make the guests to talk about. And I feel what you failed to mention is that it is not a problem with China or any particular rise or down, because that's crime when China is rising, when that's crime society is downing. And it's about humanity. China has over a billion population, and there's always horrible crimes in any time, any corner happening in the society.
Seth, may I ask, are you from China, Seth?
Yes, I'm Chinese national. Just for the purpose of disclosure, I'm Chinese. I'm a Chinese national, but...
You must know then that this isn't common what's going on here in China. We said at the outset, and it's, it of course bears repeating, China's not the only country that's had this kind of problem. Heaven knows we've had it in this country. But this is not ordinary. This is not typical for China.
Sir, I mean, I was a school social worker in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. You go to any D.C. public school, the security measures, why those security measures there? It's, the, you know, again, you, if you read the statistics, China has the probably lowest rate of violent crimes.
Quite true.
The thing is that I try to express it, that those are horrible crimes. You know, China on the rising, China on the dining, it's not excuses. Even they are political protesting, which they are not. They are totally not. If you read every case, it has nothing to do with politics. Even if they are, those are not reasons. Those are not excuses for those horrible, horrible, horrible crimes, which they are. They are just a crime, crime against humanity. It's not a crime to protest in communism or whatever. It is crime against humanity.
Seth, let us pick it up right there, and I appreciate your call very much. David Westendorf, how about it? Wen Jiabao says himself that they need to tackle social tensions. But our caller, Seth, he's Chinese, and he says there's nothing to do with politics here. This is just the human dilemma.
I have to go with Wen Jiabao in this case. I think he understands that there is the rapidity of change in China is jarring. There's no question about it. He himself would like to have, Wen Jiabao and Hu Jintao would like to have reasonably fast growth because it makes a lot of things possible. But they also are very astute sociologists themselves. They know that a country is as large and as populous and diverse as China will be, there will be frictions in moving so fast towards the future. And I think they are working as hard as they can to figure out how to do it. But it's not that easy for such a large and populous country.
Let's go to Lowell.
Tom, may I intervene?
Yes, Gubinyan, please, yes.
Yes, you know, the previous listeners' comments are really interesting. I think it may well reflect, problems with humanity. But I think we need to take a longer and historical perspective and see that these recent incidents, and in recent years there are many other kinds of incidents, really is a kind of a quite different pattern compared if we only look recent as in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, we see a change. And then we need to understand, why is this kind of change? Why is society not changing for the better? I mean, in a sense, changing to become a safer society, right? So in one sense, I think Chinese society is quite safe. You know, we often hear travelers, tourists in China, talking about the safety of Chinese streets, but we see a decline in this kind of general public safety, and we need to understand why is this happening.
Do you see danger signs here for Chinese society, for the Chinese political structure? I mean, our caller says it happens everywhere. Yes, it does, but when something like this happens, people in all countries try to interpret what's going on. Do you see dangers being indicated here for China, Gobinyang?
Well, I see contradictory patterns, and I've talked with friends and families back in China, and some people feel that everything seems to be going on very well, and others feel that they have a great deal of anxiety and frustration, even those middle class young professionals. And then there are sociologists who have written about how China is entering a stage of extreme crisis. So we see two different kinds of pictures. One is relatively safe and fine society, and the other hand is quite a situational crisis. I see, again, in historical terms, over the past 20 years or so, that we do see that Chinese society is becoming more and more contentious, that people are increasingly unhappy for all kinds of different individual reasons. But then we need to understand why is that the case, that society is, you know, on the whole, seems to be becoming more and more contentious, more and more protest activities, complaints on the individual level, as well as collective riots and protest activities. And in order to understand this kind of change, I think we do need to look at the sort of deeper level about, you know, the larger historical economic processes and how politics, how governance, how leadership is dealing with these kind of issues.
David Westendorf in Shanghai, you've got the very shiny, glossy expo going on there right now, and much of the world is fixated on China's rise. We've just got a minute here, David, but is this, in a way, the backside of the Chinese juggernaut? Does it tell us something different?
The expo being different?
No, these killings, you know, sort of juxtaposed. Yes. Are we seeing a different side of the Chinese juggernaut, sort of the dark side in these killings somehow?
I want to believe differently, simply because these in such a large country, such a highly populated country, I do agree with one of the earlier speakers. It's, you know, with so many people, these could be quite random events. They made it onto TV, that's true, and they are terrible. But there are also all kinds of other good and bad things happening in China all the time, because of its expanse. These things are happening. I have my concerns about the social stability issues based on rapid change.
We're going to have to leave it right there today. David Westendorf in Shanghai and Guobin Yang in New York, thanks to both of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.